exactly what I was told. That makes sense. And it's the band plan, the ARRL band plan, is really just a plan that we're supposed to use to be courtesy, but it's not an FCC rule or any of those details within it or rule. I think that's correct. All right, thanks for it.
Yeah, it's a gentleman's agreement, although there is discussion about setting symbol rate numbers for different portions of the band. Wesley, I think you wanted to say something.
You actually told it. The board to enter, and you said gentleman agreement. Thank you.
Okay, unfortunately, Mike is kind of going in and out again, so I'm trying to do the best I can to understand what you're saying, but about 50% of the time sometimes, and other times it's very clear, so, you know, it's the same way as last week. Yeah, that entire thing was almost non-understandable. You were about 16 dBs of audio down. It sounded like you were talking from the other side of your house.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay, that's good.
Okay. Well, I have to wait that 1.5 months till my hand tool is gonna be working, so I'm gonna fix that microphone. But in the meantime, I'm gonna try to not move when my mic is working properly.
Okay, that seems to be working, and you know, we all understand, and I don't want to make a point of reminding you of it. I just wanted to point out that if other people mentioning that's what they're alluding to, that's all.
Well, tell me every time, because talking when you're not hearing me is just interfering with you. So, yes, I need you to tell me that every time. Thank you.
That's WR2U with a comment, Roy.
Yes, Mike.
I'm having a little bit of a problem with the gentleman that said there is no necessary FCC requirement for emission bandwidth. I'm not so sure that's 100% true. Well, not to debate that, I think you have to dig into what the receiver filter bandwidths are associated with various modes. For example, a modern-day communication receiver on the HF bands, if you wanted to set up, you know, without any of the roofing filter options or anything like that, you simply wanted to set up a mechanism to receive conventional single sideband as it's generated by a properly adjusted transmitter, you'd probably find out that the receive bandwidth, the filter inside the receiver in the IF stages, has roughly a 2.7 kilohertz bandwidth. So if you tried to generate energy that was wider than that, it would be cut off by the filter. You're also doing a pretty darn disservice to the people that are sharing the side channels with you. And the same, I guess, would be true about FM. Let me drop a minute. If you tried to over-deviate an FM signal, let's say on one of these radios on a 2-meter band, which would have in place an IF filter of, let's say, maybe on the order of 10 kilohertz, to support plus or minus 5 kilohertz deviation for a FM beta of 1. If you tried to over-deviate, a lot of the sideband energy would overspill the filter and you'd sound horribly distorted and intelligible at all. So there may not be, like you say, a mandate, but I think it's mandated by what the equipment on both sides of the link has to be designed for, Roy. If you get what I'm trying to say, WI2U.
And 2KW.
Yes, Alan recognized. We'll get to you in a second. And I sort of agree with you, Mike, but nowadays modern technology confounds us all. Now, my Flex 6700 has an adjustable setting. So if I want, for some stupid reason, to send out a single sideband signal that's 6 kilocycles, I can adjust the electronic filtration system to do just that. And there are other people out there. There's a whole concept called extended single sideband, which is approximately double the bandwidth of standard single sideband. I mean, the regular SSD uses HAPEM, AM guys don't particularly appreciate them either. But to a degree, especially in the old days, you were incredibly limited by the manufacturers. But because a lot of times now the filters can be electronic and just software controlled, you can do all kinds of silly things.
Yep, I got you. I understand what you're saying about the modern digital filter technology. I was referring to the old guys like me that are hell-bent on using vintage equipment that's fixed. But, no, I agree with you. I hear what you're saying. So I guess we got a table list until we get the answer, and maybe the next gentleman who broke in has it. So back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Alan, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a limitation on bandwidth. Because the AM guys are at the high fidelity. They've got very wide signals. I've got a KWS-1 that has a mechanical filter in it for SSB. But it's a 3.1. That's the bandwidth of my sideband signal. So I don't think that it's regulated.
Okay, I'm beginning to hear you guys. Maybe it isn't.
Okay, I'm still kind of, I'm not quite sure. I think there might be something flaky that's going on in what used to be the CW portion of the band plan, where they may have some discussion about symbol rates. It may not be FCC rule, but I'm just Googling because Google is our friend, and I see here Section 97.307F of the FCC rules limits the digital data emission of amateur radio stations operating below 28 megahertz to a symbol rate not to exceed 300 baud, and on 10 meters to a symbol rate not to exceed 1200 baud. So there seems to be a symbol rate restriction for some of the parts of the amateur band. I don't think too many of us are aware of them. But I think they do actually exist someplace in the fine print.
N2TU?
Yes, N2TU.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the bands above 50 megahertz, but I know on the HF bands, you can't have a voice signal that has a modulation index more than 1, which means wideband FM is illegal. That's why there's no FM on the HF bands.
Okay, yeah, that's another additional rule. But I know there are little bits and pieces where people get around them. Again, with extended single sideband, as far as I'm aware, right now it's legal to send out a very wide single sideband signal that's as wide as 6 kilohertz, and the FCC won't come knocking on your door. But there seems to be rules, especially about digital data, the symbol rates of those things. Alan, did you want to say something?
No, I think I said it all. There may be a restriction on bandwidth in the CW section, but there can't be in the phone section. Just think, you think that a 6 kilohertz wide sideband signal is broad, and I'm thinking of an AM signal, 6 kilohertz is quite narrow.
HUSDP.
Yes, Chris recognized. Now, I agree with you, Alan. I think that the 97.307F is about the what used to be known as the CW portion, but now is kind of generically thought of as the digital data / CW. For those, they've instituted a symbol rate limitation, which, you know, no one in their right mind can figure out what the symbol rate of a CW signal is. So it's pretty much the computer-generated digital modes that people have to deal with, things that are more than 300 baud rate signals. But Chris, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, thanks, Roy. K2SDP. I've seen a long time ago, I remember reading about the symbol rate limitation the FCC has that you just read, and I've often wondered what the point of that is. I wondered if it had something to do with they don't want people talking too fast because they might miss something, you know, that kind of nonsense. But anyway, interesting story of how I heard there was no bandwidth limit is when I first turned on my 7300, ICOM 7300, got on at HF, brand new antenna, brand new ham license, no idea what I'm doing. I was talking to some guys, and they were talking to me about their microphones, and were asking me if they sounded better with mic one over mic two, and I couldn't hear any difference. And finally, one of them couldn't understand why I couldn't hear a difference. Finally, he said, "What radio on?" And I said, "A 7300. He said, "It's right out of the box, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah." And they quickly guided me through the menus to up the bandwidth and change the filters. So they come pretty closed down, or to widen them, of course. And then I heard the differences on the microphone, and they proceed. I then asked what the bandwidth was, and they proceeded to tell me there is no FCC limit. So I've always assumed that. And there is a guy, well-known guy here on Long Island, who often is 50K wide on AM, K2FDP.
That's way square.
Okay, could you give me your call sign again? Because I couldn't quite make it out. There was a little too much background noise.
N2HYR, November 2, Hotel Yankee, Romeo.
Okay, well, what would you like to say, N2HYR? What's your first name, by the way?
Name is Jeff. Anyway, the 300 baud and the 1200 baud things pretty much pertain to packet rates set, you know, many years ago. That's pretty much where it applies. Nothing to do with CW or RIDI or any of those other modes per se.
They're alluding to digital modes, which I guess depends upon what year that rule was written, might only just be PACTER. So that would be interesting. I think part of it, because there's been ongoing talk about the FCC offering some other limitations of bandwidth on the band sometime in the future. But to just touch back on Chris's question of why, I think to a degree the FCC wanted to have open available frequencies. It was kind of designed for CW in mind. And one of the last things they wanted to see was someone come up with some kind of a digital mode that took up a wide swath of bandwidth and operated on the CW bands and impacted on CW operators. I think the FCC and ARRL have a sweet spot for our CW operators, as do we all.
Yes, they didn't want it to exceed any sideband bandwidth that was already agreed to. CW, by its very nature, can be very, very narrow band, inherently.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of CW. That's the reason why a lot of people interested in QRP tend to use their CW skills. Certainly more than phone with a much less efficient, wider bandwidth.
It's certainly possible to stay within a bandwidth of 100 hertz.
Yeah, we were discussing CW bandwidth for the better part of, I think, 45 minutes about two or three Sundays ago. So yeah, CW is still live and well, and one of the great things is its very narrow bandwidth. I mean, one of the great features of the new low signal strength Joe Taylor digital method is to keep the symbol rate very, very, very low and to increase, add additional error correction algorithms to it. So, you know, you can get very, very far on those FT8 digital modes. And they have a very narrow bandwidth.
Yes, that's a whole new area I have to start to investigate. I haven't really enough. I've heard some of them, but I don't know who they are. I need to do more research, as they say. But even the highest speed CW stays very narrow.
Yeah, it is indeed. And you should just check it out. I mean, it's not for everyone. There was a time that someone was actually doing FT8 at the same time that he was listening and interacting in the chat room with the technical net. And I think by the end of the technical net, he had decided that it was just not enough of a challenge for him, because I know a lot of people who do FT8 in addition to something else. They write emails, they check their records for the next day business. They do all kinds of things simultaneously. And a lot of people don't mind that. They get wall paper for their walls with worked all this and worked all that. But other people kind of look at it and say, you know, it's sort of like the philosophy of some people will not indulge in a sport where you can drink a can of beer while you're doing that sport. Okay, let's go back to Rich. Any further questions on the subject? Because we went a little bit far away from your original question.
No, everybody was great. My understanding of the fundamentals of it now is greatly improved. I ordered a book 2 days ago. I ordered a book on RF because I really do want to get a full understanding of what's going on after all these years in ham radio. I never got down to the nitty-gritty, so thanks, everybody. I really do appreciate it. Thanks, Mike, and thanks, Roy.
Well, you're welcome, Rich, and as long as I have Mike WY2U on the TechNet tonight, did you ever have a chance to look further into that interesting antenna from QST? Every month I look for the letters to the editor, and I've yet to find anyone mentioning good, bad, or indifferent about that antenna. So I was wondering if you ever tried to simulate it.
Oh, you know, I meant to bring that up a while ago. Well, I tried. I can tell you that. Unfortunately, the computers, the personal computers and the software that I'm using, the EasyNet software, does not have anywhere near the amount of horsepower needed to adequately model wires that are that close together to try to come up with radiation properties in a conventional transmission line. Sorry to say, I wasn't able to get anything meaningful, so the jury's still out on that one, Roy, sorry to say, but again, the software just doesn't have the capability to do any kind of modeling of that sophistication. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry to hear that. I'm doing a bunch of articles. I write articles for our little newsletter, so I'm collecting a bunch of them if I keep learning how to use the antenna simulation software. I probably will have them start publishing in September when the newsletter kind of starts up for the second half of the year. And one of them was about using a RF choke on a dipole. And I was able, hopefully, to simulate common mode coming off of the coax. It was a nice representation. I mean, if you want, I'll send you the article. And so, you know, I was able to simulate it for those purposes. I'm having a little problem getting a good simulation for a random NFET, though. Still working on that. It's a very big, complicated piece of software. It's not the easiest to master in a few weeks or a few months.
I was using the conventional EasyNet version 7. And the limitation that has is it's the method of moments analysis, if you're familiar with it. When you start bringing wires very, very close together and try to make a transmission line or an antenna using, let's say, linear loading or something like that, where the spacing between the conductors starts to approach a very small number of wavelengths, you need a very large number of current pulses on the wire to get anything meaningful. So I even started with about 500 current pulses. It has the ability to model up to about 7,000. And every time I double or halve the amount of pulses, the answer never converged. So I never really got the impression that what was coming out was valid. So that's why I say I don't think I have the horsepower. I don't know how many current pulses you would need to do a proper simulation, but up to several thousand did not allow me to get an answer that converged properly, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay. Is your email on QRZ? If it is, I'll send you a copy of that article that shows common mode, and I put in a simulated choke and demonstrated why it's a good idea to put in a choke to a dipole. So do you have I'm sure I have your email someplace otherwise, but are you on QRZ?
Yes, I am. I am on QRZ, and I'm good. But my son just came in. It turns out he wanted to give me something for Father's Day. I was waiting on him. So, I got my present. How about that? Thank you, Keith. let me run. But this was an interesting discussion tonight, guys. I really appreciate it. But again, I didn't get the impression, Roy, that the software that I had would lead you to believe that the results are valid. But yes, I am good in QRZ, rather. And if not, DM Cosma, DM Delta Mike, KOZMA, at optonline.net. The whole world knows it anyway, so you can send it to me. I'm good there, and I'll take a look at it. But I really got to run, guys, so let me get out of here. Guys, it's been a pleasure, and you guys enjoy the rest of the night. WY2, you're clear.
Okay, very good, Mike. Thank you so much for your participation and for giving us all this good information. And Rich will go look a bunch of stuff up and come up with some more questions probably next Sunday.
Good night, everybody. Thanks.
And thanks, Jim.
Yes, Wesley.
Mission and circulating software. I can prepare for the next week. Just now. The antenna coupler. So, the antenna coupler, what is the difference between coupler and antenna tuner? It's the antenna, right next to the dipole.
Well, Wesley, you're dropping at around 40%. I'm able to pick up most of the things that you're saying. I don't know if I would thought to say that there's a, if you have an antenna tuner at the feed point, it's a coupler, and if you have it at the shack, it's a tuner. Again, as it is, we trip over words all the time, so I just kind of like to say a tuner in the shack versus a tuner at the feed point. You know, there are people out there who either buy them specially designed weatherproof, and if you do that, you'll get less coax cable losses. You don't have to deal with the open line transmission line in those cases. But I don't know, to kind of add coupler to tuner, I think is an additional thing that people are going to get wrong too many times.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
A coupler is put at the feed point of an antenna. Its purpose is to match the antenna 250 ohm feed line. Or whether the other impedance is needed, but usually it is 50 ohm. And the coupler keeps WR down along the whole feed line, while the tuner does not. So, someone wants to take a stand, what is the difference between tuner and the coupler?
Answer KW.
Yes, Alan.
My mobile setup is an IC706. And an AH4 antenna tuner, which tunes a 108-inch whip at the feed point. I don't see any difference between a tuner and a coupler. Over.
Yeah, I think we're dealing with semantics, something I hate to deal with.
I'll have to tell Jeff Semantics that, Roy.
Well, generally speaking, on an average technical net, at least 10% of discussions tend to degenerate into semantical, wordplay and such. By the way, we have a little bit of a problem with EchoLink popping in and out and in and out. And when that happens and people transmit on EchoLink, they feed into the repeater and the guy talking on the radio sounds like he put up the gate. So if you hear transmissions of people and all of a sudden they go up 6 decibels in audio, it's because someone is keying up the echo link transmission. Just that people forgot about that little problem we have.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you now. I mean, it was a little bit difficult just before when someone was keying up the echo link, but instead of dropping down 16 decibels, you went up 6 decibels.
So I'm looking at SGT, which is one of the leaders in professional radio and ham radio. I don't know how many people remember the SGC transceiver. And it says that the tuner tunes the output of the transceiver to the coax. And the coupler tunes the antenna to the coax and to XGN.
Again, to me, it's a semantic argument that doesn't really get you anywhere because it's all just one antenna system. You know, from the antenna tuner, wherever it is, all the way up to the antenna. A lot of people consider that the antenna system, and whether you put the impedance matching at the front or at the back, it has an impact upon the attenuation losses, but ultimately it's still transforming the impedances. So, you know, it's nice that they want to kind of divide the two, so that they can have twice as many products. But, I mean, ultimately, if you talk to a standard operating ham, they're not going to talk to you about an antenna coupler. They're going to say, I have an antenna tuner that's weatherproof, and I put it right on the feed point of the antenna. And, you know, if you want to correct their English, I don't know, but there's enough English correction going on.
KW.
Yes, Alan.
I can't understand how you'd put anything at the feed point. It's too heavy. Most of the remote tuners, they put at the base of the antenna. You're tuning to run a coax anyway. And, you know, theoretically, it's right. You want to do your matching at the far end so you don't have loss in the cable. But in the real world, that loss is actually quite small. It's very convenient to have an ATU in the shack, over.
Yeah, I agree with you, but it sort of depends upon the length of the coax and the frequency of the coax, the attenuation loss, the degree of the impedance mismatching you're dealing with. And, you know, I mean, it might not be directly at the feed point. There are some verticals where the feed point is approachable, and you can tack on a weatherproof antenna tuner on the mast and wire it up. So, again, we're having discussions of, you know, if it's a foot or two away from the feed point, to me, it's at the feed point for all intents and purposes, as opposed to the other side of your shack. But there are people, I have my antenna feed, the tuner in my shack. I don't feel the need to have it hooked up externally or buy an external one, but there are people out there that do.
That's what I always thought was you needed an external one until I started using the tuner that's built into transceivers. No difference. it's not worth it. What a hassle.
Okay, but then you're sort of limiting the amount of impedance matching that you require, which is a good thing, but a lot of people need more than the 3-to-1 that most internal antenna tuners are designed to provide in modern Japanese radios. You know, there are guys that basically are trying to tune a doorknob.
Then you need another ATU in addition to the one that's in the radio. But I still don't see it as a coupler. It's an ATU. I got an ATU at the base of my whip at the feed point.
PG2R1?
Yes, David recognized. But just to get back to Alan, you know, it's sort of potato-potato. It's an impedance-transforming device. You could call it that. You could call it an antenna tuner. You could call it a coupler, I guess, although that's less descriptive. But there are many ways to call something that does the same thing. So, David, you wanted to say something?
USL, good evening, everybody. Roy, I remember Dick talking about this, you know, external tuner, antenna side versus antenna tuner shock side, you know. And he was talking about, like, you know, long wire antennas, and antennas that weren't resonant, and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Can you elaborate?
Okay, I don't know if I could sum up all of Dick's wisdom or 1% of Dick's wisdom. The concept is that if you have a perfectly resonant antenna that has a perfect impedance match, of course, you don't need any kind of external to the antenna impedance transformer. If you do need an impedance transformer, the most efficient method, all things being equal, is to apply the impedance transformation at the point of the antenna feed, you know, or at the antenna itself, and basically to make it resonant and have a impedance match with a 50-ohm nominal coaxial cable. If you introduce that impedance matching circuit farther up in the transmission line, you will have a degree of reflected power being lost as part of the attenuation of any cable design. They all attenuate to one degree or another. It might be imperceptible. It might be relatively meaningless, but nevertheless, it's non-zero. So that's a quick version of where to put your antenna tuner.
QSL, LDG, auto tuner in the shack. Thank you very much.
WB2AHK.
Yes, Jeff.
All right. There was a gentleman said something, why would you want to have an external antenna tuner? I might have got the gist wrong. I was on the computer listening with 110 AM. But my particular case, my rig, HF rig, has a automatic antenna tuner, but I have an amplifier. And my amplifier and my antenna needed a tuner between them because my rigs, which is an FTDX-1200, can only tune to, you know, a 100-watt transmitter, but the amplifier is 1,500 watts, and I needed a tuner in between the antenna just to get the impedance right. In my particular case, I needed an external tuner because of the amplifier. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have the exact same situation. My Flex 6700 has an internal antenna tuner. They can deal with about a 3-to-1, not much more. But I like to put it through my Expert 1.3 linear amp, which for a lot of money I could have gotten with a built-in antenna tuner in itself. But instead, I have a Palomar that it outputs to, and I use the Palomar, which has a much wider range of impedance tuning. Unfortunately, no antenna tuner has a properly documented, Smith chart of the range of impedances that it can transform. It would be very nice if they did that, but no one does that. So although some 10-to-1 impedance mismatches can be handled by my antenna tuner if the angle is different, sometimes the same impedance with a different phase angle can't be corrected by the circuit. So yeah, I do this. I have the same thing going on. I very much appreciate my Palomar HF Auto, Palstar. Sorry, Palstar.
All right. Final thing I'm going to say is my new solid state amplifier did not like the impedance load that it's seeing from my antenna to the amplifier. My automatic antenna tuner without on the rig, without the amplifier in line, is very happy.
very happy. The automatic antenna tune in the rig brings it down to, no SWR at all, a complete beautiful match. But my amplifier is too picky and it goes offline. Solid state amplifiers are not forgiving, like tube amplifiers. So in any case, in my case, I put the tuner in and my amplifier is very happy. It never goes off offline anymore. Thanks very much, Roy. Bye-bye. Okay, very good. Yeah, mine has an alarm if it goes past 1.5, and, 1.6 isn't a terrible visual, but 1.5 and it squeals like a pig. And obviously, the problem is that your antenna tuner is only going to transform the impedance at that point where you introduce it into the chain. So as far as your transmitter is concerned, it's seeing an output of 50 ohms and it's happy. But as far as your linear is concerned, it sees the external visual uncorrected. So that makes it very, very unhappy. It doesn't understand or care that you've corrected the impedance further along the chain.
KG2R1?
Yes, David.
You know, Roy, I've heard stories like this, Person has a long random wire, a antenna tuner at the feed point, and what they call it, parallel, let's say the cable ladder line to the shack. And it seems to work very well. The antenna is hardly resonant at all, but for some reason it seems to work okay with linear amplifiers.
Okay, I mean, there's different ways of handling it. The difference is that the attenuation loss of open line, ladder line, such window pane is much, much lower. Much lower. So you could have reflected losses of initial mismatch before your antenna tuner does its magic, and you're not going to lose that much. If you're using a coax cable, that reflected current is going to be lost in heat due to the attenuation loss. A very common presentation to this day is something called a doublet. Doublet is a not particularly resonant dipole. It's not designed to be a half wave of anything. But instead of being fed by a cable, a coax, it's fed by open line. And then that goes into hopefully a balanced antenna tuner, where the antenna tuner does the resonating magic for that doublet. So that's a doublet. Or you could use an unbalanced version in the way of just a random wire with an open line. Or you could be fancy and you could short out the open line and make the wire half a dipole, and then you got a Zeppelin. So there's a lot of different things that you can do with open line. But the reason why some people play with open line is because it's a low attenuation loss, and it's a little bit more efficient when you have to do a lot of correction with a antenna tuner in your shack.
Thank you, Roy.
And thanks, Jim.
Yes, Wesley.
Actually, you have an American telling that it's a matter of semantic, although we're dealing with two separate devices, and one is definitely designed to be mounted on the end of the coaxial cable and the other next to the transceiver. So the description of the SGC, reputable company, making a lot of stuff for the military and commercial and for ham radio. I don't know if they made any new product for ham radio now, but they have a smart tuner too, SGC. So what I say is, Okay, so now what is it? It's not my microphone, Dr. Roy. It's somebody putting carrier on me. Did you hear what I said? Somebody's putting carrier on me. It's not my microphone.
You say? I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah, it's a curious presentation. I don't exactly know why, but I never know why people act out like this.
I'm gonna turn my antenna to the repeater, and it's gonna be done. It's gonna be over. I'm gonna repeat what I said. So give me some time. Back to you.
Okay, very good. I just want to once again point out that unfortunately, you know, do the grammar police go over to SGC and arrest them for use of the term antenna coupler? No. It's just that if you talk to an amateur radio operator, if you look at MFJ, because MFJ kind of sells everything, if you look at MFJ's auto tuners, that are capable, that are weatherproofed and capable of being mounted at the antenna site, you are not going to see them call it an antenna coupler. They call it a remote auto tuner. And 99% of amateurs know what a remote auto tuner is, and I'm willing to bet you that not even 10% of amateurs know what an antenna coupler would be.
Okay, I believe it's much better right now. I put my antenna directly on the repeater.
Okay, I hope you didn't put it directly on the repeater, because then you'd burn out the front end of the receiver there.
So it's only 8 watts. Okay. So it's only 8 watts. What they say is, so which way do you want? A tuner built into the rig is there to protect the transceiver, not to give you the best signal. It's going to be a simple, and most HF frequency losses will be fairly minimal on the practical level. A coupler at the antenna feed point will maximize your energy flow into the antenna, giving you the best signal possible with physical antenna. Most magic section two are only for a single frequency and small band around the frequency. And they, of course, want you to buy their tuner. Back to you.
Okay, like I said, I understand. I don't know if that's a standard use or just that brand's use of the term, again, because I have never seen anything. I haven't read too many SGC ads, because they really haven't been producing anything for the amateur radio market in a while. I could just judge from catalogs and magazines and all manner of things. And I cannot for the life of me recall a single time any of them allude to an antenna coupler. Again, nothing against it. It's just that if you talk to the average ham, they won't know what you're talking about. Whereas if you tell them you're thinking of buying a remote auto tuner, they'll pretty much know what you're talking about.
Yeah, actually you're right. Actually you're right. The gentleman who's putting a carrier on me is actually taking a chance when my antenna is not on the repeater. With 8 watts, I can increase it to 100 watts on that antenna directly on line of sight to the repeater, but I want to do it, so it's probably 8, 9 watts right now.
Okay, I hope this solves the problem. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of interesting discussions about semantics, and sometimes I'm guilty of it. There is supposedly a difference between a diplexer and a duplexer. You use a diplexer in your shack, you use a duplexer in your repeater. They do similar things, but not identical things. And yet, occasionally now, I see that the Japanese are selling diplexers and labeling them as duplexers. So that's the nature of the language. It tends to kind of either change or deteriorate according to your own particular perspective. So, you know, there are some semantic arguments that I'll die on a hill for, but it wouldn't be couplers. I'd probably spare my life and let people call it whatever they want to.
2KW.
Yes, Alan.
I think there's a big difference between a diplexer and a duplexer.
I do too, but then the Japanese kind of screw around with it by mislabeling their diplexer as a duplexer. If you go to, I don't know, Ham Radio University, I don't remember exactly the company, but some Japanese like Daiwa or something, they sell a diplexer and you can see it on the cover of the box. It says duplexer.
Interesting.
Yes, Wesley?
Okay. A diplexer, we're talking about a passive device that has the frequency domain with duplexing. It can multiplex into the third port, right? Now, the duplexer is a device that allows bidirectional duplex communication of a single path. So that would be the difference, right?
Yes, in my world, yes. But again, if you look up Comet Daiwa duplexer, you will see basically a diplexer being called a duplexer. So, unfortunately, it's very difficult. Yeah, it's great to have semantic arguments with people if you just read from the dictionary and you tell people what should be and shouldn't be, but then they hand you an actual commercial product that's mislabeled, and that kind of adds to the confusion.
You have the confidence to say this product is mislabeled.
And I do. But still, you know, you'd be surprised how many people kind of shrug and walk away. Because they make assumptions, and we all make assumptions, and this one's an incorrect one. But again, you know, if I write a letter to Comet and say, why are you doing this, I am sure that that letter is going to land in a circular filing cabinet on the ground.
Unfortunately, you're probably right, and 2KW out.
I mean, ultimately, that's the problem. Language is something agreed upon. We make stuff up all the time, and some of us change the meaning of things without telling the rest of us, and it leads to a lot of confusion. So during those transition points, everyone's yelling at each other and saying it's pronounced often, not often. And eventually, sometimes it settles out, and sometimes it never settles out.
You know, I've tuned a duplexer. It puts a very deep notch on a signal that's only 600 KCOA. Tuned it, they have big cavities. I don't think diplexers are adjustable at all, and they're a little box, but that allows you to use a tri-band antenna with two different transceivers.
AC2GS. I agree with you 100%. It's a misuse of the term. It is an error on the part of Comet, but since Comet seems to make a significant number of diplexers for amateur radio operators, there's a lot of guys out there with little boxes that call themselves duplexers, which is going to lead them to call them duplexes eventually, I'm afraid. You know, unless all of a sudden something changes. It's kind of difficult to have an argument. I mean, you've dealt with repeaters. I've even dealt with repeaters. I know what a duplexer looks like. They're a lot different. They're a lot more expensive. They take up a lot more space, you know, cavity filters. And they're a bigger pain in the ass to deal with because you have to tune them. You don't tune, as you mentioned, the diplexers. It's a rather simple, bandpass filter type of situation going on. So potato, potato, it ain't. It's more like potato and boulder. But nevertheless, for the sake of one vowel, Comet has kind of screwed it up for everyone.
And takes you.
Yes, Wesley.
Okay. Somebody put the carrier on. And let me explain how my system works. So the antenna is on the hand tilt and is able to be turned to any direction. It takes some time for that antenna to turn, and then the signal is analyzed by the software. And the significant pattern of the software is based on the signal character. Now, the identity of the person who is trying to put a carrier on me or anybody else is then... Okay, now he's listening because this gentleman needs to listen. So then the authenticity of that person then is being is based on his regular transmission. So either the radio has to scan and eventually catch the signal and compare the pattern to the one that is recorded, or and that person is actually not aware of the fact that his pattern of his radio is being compared to that one from the software. And now we have the person who is putting noise on another person, and we can report it to the FCC. But do we need that? So I'm asking again. I spot one guy already, and I told that guy that he was doing it. Now I'm asking again. Don't put a carrier on me, because it doesn't pay. And to exceed.
Well, I hope the guy learns his lesson and finds something more productive to do with his life. I agree with anyone who has to spend their time doing this, because I would rather do anything other than screw other people's lives up. I mean, life is screwed up as it is. I don't think it needs any help, but I wish you good luck, Wesley, and I hope your adversary out there, you know, takes up a new hobby, maybe. You know, crocheting, I hear, is very calming.
N2KW.
Yes, Alan, any comments about crocheting or anything in general?
Yeah, I got a very strong comment. You should never discuss an unidentified transmission. They thrive on attention. You're giving them attention. What are you, crazy? You don't hear it. If there's no call sign, you don't hear it. That's it. And the other thing is, I would appreciate it if people came to net control with a question. Send 2KW over.
Actually, you're right. That's right.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
The club recommends that we just give out the email, listen to the input, and you put in RFI@limoc.org, and you give the report. That's it. Back to you.
Okay, very good advice, Paul. I generally do not respond to people if I can do it, and or just feel sorry for the poor schnooks out there. Nevertheless, I understand your attitude, Alan. Anyone out there with any actual questions about amateur radio, please give me your first name and your call sign. We still have a little bit more time.
Send 2KW. I want to follow up on that.
Certainly, Alan.
If I'm on 20CW and I just finished a contact and somebody comes on my frequency and says, "Hello, Alan," I don't ask who it is. No call sign. I didn't hear it. Over.
Okay, I understand. I don't think I actually have conversations with unidentified people per se. I just have random thoughts that occur to me, and I transmit them. That's the way I see it, at least. But I understand where you're coming from. Once again, anyone out there with any questions, hopefully amateur radio related, but we'll take science or anything that tickles your interest.
I have a question. So Kenwood did too. The question. balconies, anybody has it, anybody can... Remember correctly, it doesn't have 2 meter, but it's an excellent radio. Please see and Dr. Roy.
Yeah, maybe try that again. Second time's the charm, maybe?
Okay. FTDX10, ESO transceiver. FTDX10, ESO transceiver. And Ken would put you one or two. My question is, does anybody have it or know about it or can say something about it? Dr. Roy.
Okay, well, Wesley is interested in the FTDX10. Anyone out there have any experience with that model?
KG2RY.
Yes, David?
I spoke with the ASU about the FTDX, and then what I come to realize is all good and it's worth the money. I spoke to a dealer about the new Kenwood, which is the TS590SG, and specifically he said it's old technology, but, you know, old technology can be very good.
WF2N.
Yes, Paul.
I called HRL looking for the 7300, and there's a waiting list months down the line. But they are pushing the DX10. You know, they have them in stock, and they say that's a good competitor. They're actually pushing that. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, that's an all-time favorite. When I was first getting into this hobby, it was the Kenwood TS2000 that every other guy on the bands was talking with. And then all of a sudden it kind of shifted to the 7300 a couple of years ago. So that's a high-demand one. Yaesu's FTDX10, as far as I'm aware, it's a software-defined radio. I think it's a hybrid in that one is an IF, a Fed SDR, the other is a wider bandwidth version, unless I have them confused.
Well, the salesman claims that it's a better receiver than the 7300, but I don't know that, of course. Back to you.
I was reading some reviews, and they also said that.
That it's better than a 7300?
The receiver. They even said that the Kenwood TS590SG is a better receiver than the 7300. But, you know, people can say all kinds of things.
Price is also $1,550, if I remember correctly.
Engineering lists and such. It depends. I mean, there are some specifications that you could measure on test equipment that most people can't perceive in their ears. And the thing that really counts is how that particular radio sounds to a person. That's why, all things being equal, it's a great thing if you find some local ham who has that particular model and will let you have a little chance to listen in on it and test it out for yourself. You know, guys who live where there's a retail store have they can at least turn the dials and look at the darn thing. Unless we're going to take a trip someplace, we order these things mail order, and the first time we see them sometimes is uncartoning them.
And the price is great, $1,550, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, DX Engineering is selling it for
$1,399.95. Wow. That's really good money. TS2000 used one sells for the same. Interesting.
Well, I mean, I think part of the future, unless inflation really bites us in the backside, is that the software-defined radios are able to usually give better specs with less expensive parts. So this will probably be an ongoing trend where the receiver and transmitter specs, mostly the receiver, get better and better and the price points go down. So, you know, we got a few